FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, here on March 21st, 2010. Today we have a terrific show for you. Our guest is one of the great economists and economic writers of our times. We'll be joined by Dean Baker to discuss his new book, False Prophets, and to talk about the state of the economy and how the last scandal and crisis was handled and what we have in store for us coming up. Should be an extraordinary hour today, but first, before we go to Dean Baker, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Federal Communications Commission unveiled its long-awaited national broadband plan this week after more than a year of work. FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski called the plan a 21st century roadmap to spur economic growth and investment, create jobs, educate our children, protect our citizens, and engage in our democracy. Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott says that the National Broadband Plan makes it clear that broadband is no longer a luxury. Scott says that when you get into the details of the plan, there are many things that the FCC got right.
They have developed a pretty detailed plan for transitioning the Universal Service Fund, which is a big government program that subsidizes rural and low-income telephone service today. They want to transition that into broadband and make that subsidy support broadband. They also have an interesting proposal on how to reallocate the public airwaves to make better use of them. And there's another interesting section on cable set-top boxes. The FCC has a plan to open the market for set-top boxes and let consumers buy their own devices and use them on any cable system. So that's a real step in the right direction.
The agency also plans on improving the way it collects information on broadband prices and speeds, which Scott admits is not very sexy, but will become very important for policymakers. But there are other pressing issues on which the agency punted.
The big failure, I think, comes in the lack of a specific plan about how to get prices to come down and speeds to go up so that our networks resemble those of the world leaders in Europe and in Asia. The Commission gets the problem right, but their solution doesn't really tackle the tough questions that would bloody the noses of the big phone and cable companies. They defer those fights to another day. The bottom line for the broadband plan is it's a step in the right direction, but the real work is yet to come when we begin to implement it and tackle some of these major questions.
To read the FCC's National Broadband Plan, go to fcc.gov.
The Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood works to limit deceptive marketing techniques targeted at kids. They've battled stealth advertising in report cards and on school buses, and marketing schemes such as the one that promoted highly sexualized Bratz dolls at Scholastic book clubs and fairs. Up until very recently, the campaign was a program of the Judge Baker Children's Center, a Harvard-affiliated children's mental health center in Boston. But the group was evicted from the center after their highly successful and highly visible fight to get the Walt Disney Company to offer refunds on Baby Einstein videos, which the company had been falsely marketing as educational. Susan Lin, executive director of the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood, says that studies have shown that time spent by babies in front of the TV screen actually takes valuable time away from those practices that really do work, like spending time with loving adults and engaging in creative play. After the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission about Disney's false and deceptive marketing, Disney changed its tactics. But, Lin says,
the FTC never held them publicly accountable, so there was no public acknowledgement that they had been deceiving parents, and so we thought that parents deserved better than that.
The Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood threatened a class action suit against Disney, which prompted the company to offer refunds to anyone who had bought the videos in the past 5 years. But the victory celebration was short-lived. Under pressure from Disney, Lynn's group was told they needed to leave the Judge Baker Center. And they were warned not to speak to the press or do any work that was critical of an individual corporation or product.
I'm a psychologist. I really believe that it's the mission of Children's Health Standards to stand up to anybody who may be potentially harming children, no matter how powerful that entity or that person is. It's chilling that a corporation, you know, especially one that markets itself as family friendly, would lean on a children's mental health center. And it's just heartbreaking that the center just kind of caved.
3 months after being kicked out of Judge Baker, CCFC has found a new home and is gearing up for a national conference in April.
We always knew that we were taking on very, very, very powerful interests. You know, we take on the most powerful corporations in the world, and now we've experienced the ways that we can be hurt by doing that. I will say, however, that it has only made us more determined to carry on our work.
For more information about the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, go to commercialfreechildhood.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone who's been on the program many times in the past, and I hope will be on the program many times in the future. He is Dean Baker, the author of the new book, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, just released by Polypoint Press. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and probably one of the most cited and most renowned economist and economic journalist in the United States today. He correctly anticipated and warned about the housing bubble before virtually anyone else in the field was expressing any concern about it. He has a distinguished record, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to our show. Dean, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
I just finished reading your new book, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, which is a phenomenal read, and I recommend it strongly to listeners who probably might not feel comfortable with most economic analysis, but are very concerned about what's going on with the economy. It's written in your style, which is very accessible, but also never sacrificing the rigor of the content to make something more digestible for the lay reader. First of all, let's talk about your basic reason for writing the book, which is your concern that we're in the midst right now of a rewrite of history, recent history, to sort of disguise what actually has taken place in the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, you know, and of course I wrote about this in the past, as you're good enough to point out, I was talking about the housing bubble, and this was going to burst. Bubbles do burst. That's what makes them bubbles. And it was going to have devastating impacts on the economy, and to my mind, that's sort of front and center in the story. Now, this has been rewritten to call it a financial crisis, and there were certainly aspects of it that were, you know, there was a financial crisis, no doubt about it. But to my mind, it was very much secondary. The real story here was that we had a housing bubble and that burst, and I think we'd be pretty much in the same situation we are today, even if we had not had a financial crisis. But more importantly, the financial crisis that's being portrayed as though, well, the financial crisis is just something that hit us out of the blue, and, you know, no one could really be blamed for it. And you get this story where, you know, this who could have known thing, and we have, I just mentioned one, but I could go on. Ben Bernanke gets reappointed as Fed chair because supposedly he saved us from a second Great Depression. And, you know, to my mind, I just go, well, there was no story where we would have had a second Great Depression. We have nothing particularly to thank Ben Bernanke for. I mean, yes, it could have been worse. That's always a true statement. No matter where we are, you could always say it could have been worse. So you could say that. But the point was, he is responsible for one of the biggest policy blunders, economic policy blunders of the last century. He, along with certainly Alan Greenspan by his side, and to reappoint him to that job, it's just, you know, it was just kind of astounding. But that was done, and so many people applauded it. Certainly, among, you know, sort of the intelligentsia, you know, just about everyone applauded it. And you go, how can you applaud such a dismal failure? So what we've done here is we've rewritten this from an entirely foreseeable, preventable catastrophe into something like a natural disaster, like a hurricane that kind of hit us out of the blue. And, you know, no, we can't blame anyone for being responsible for a hurricane. Maybe we could have responded more quickly. When this was a 100% preventable event. So we've just had a total rewrite of history right in front of our eyes, and the villains have been turned around to be heroes.
Dean Baker, explain exactly why it was preventable. What did take place? What did Ben Bernanke do or not do that he should have done or not done, in your view?
Well, this goes back to the 90s. We had a stock bubble, of course, driving the economy in the at least beginning mid-90s and certainly by the late 90s. And that led to good years of growth. I mean, we had a lot of demand in the economy, 98, 99, 2000. We got the unemployment rate down to 4%. That was a very good story you could tell. It was real wage growth for people at the middle and bottom, which hadn't been true since the 60s, at least not sustained real wage growth. So there's a lot of good things you could say about it, but the point was that was not sustainable. Bubble burst in 2000, 2001, 2002. We got the downturn in that period, and officially, the official story is that was a short, mild recession, no problem getting out of it. Well, the reality, the recession was dated as being March of 2001 to November 2001, 7 months, which is about as short as a recession could be. The downturn in the economy wasn't that large during that period. But the reality was we lost jobs through the end of 2001, all through 2002, and in fact, two-thirds of the way through 2003. It wasn't until the fall of 2003 that the economy actually started generating jobs again. And when it did, it was being driven by a housing bubble. So what we had was, in effect, a stock bubble being replaced by a housing bubble as the driving force of the economy. And through the recovery, 03, 04, 05, 06, you saw house prices get more and more out of line with fundamentals, which both directly drove the economy through its effect on construction. Residential construction was booming with huge amount of homes being built. And secondly, it indirectly drove the economy because it created all this wealth. People who had a home that they bought for $200,000, something worth $300,000, sometimes $400,000, and they were spending based on that wealth. So there was a huge consumption boom, and that was what was driving the economy. Now, Bernanke, and I mentioned Bernanke, it's important for people to understand, he was appointed as Fed chair in January 2006, relatively late in the game, but he was already a member of the Board of Governors. There's only seven of the Board of Governors, and Bernanke was certainly the most prominent other than Greenspan, the chair. But Bernanke was right alongside Greenspan from 2002, so that's why I'm holding him responsible. It's not just for what he did as Fed chair of January 2006. He was there from the summer of 2002. What they should have done was try to curb this bubble before it grew to such enormous levels. And the first thing that I've said, and it's funny, I raise this with economists, and they always belittle, and they go, well, what would have been the harm in trying? Should have talked about it. I don't mean, you know, whisper. You know, Greenspan famously mumbled irrational exuberance back in 96 talking about the stock bubble. I don't care, you know, about their irrational exuberance. I mean, document the evidence. That's what I was doing. Show how you have this unprecedented run-up in prices that can't be explained by anything. And not just do it personally. The Federal Reserve Board employs hundreds of economists. They should have put out research carefully documenting the fact that there was a bubble in the housing market, refuting anyone who argued against it, talking about the consequences both for the economy and the financial institutions that are involved in fueling it. I think that by itself would have been sufficient. They also have enormous regulatory powers. You know, that again, one of the current myths is, well, no one recognized how bad, you know, you had all these subprime loans, these exotic loans that were being made. No one realized that's garbage. I mean, I had people around the country sending me emails about their friend, their cousin who was a mortgage banker, and they're being told to fill in numbers for people. So someone comes in and wants to borrow $200,000, and they say their income's $50,000. And of course, you can't borrow $200,000 if your income's $50,000. So they'd say, well, put down $80,000. And this wasn't an individual decision. It wasn't that you had a rogue mortgage banker here or there. That was being decided as a policy decision at places like Countrywide, New Century, other major actors in the subprime market. Now, Greenspan had to know about that. Bernanke had to know about that. I don't have regulatory powers. They do. And, you know, they should have been taking steps to curb it, and instead they just gave the blessing, everything is great.
Our guest, Dean Baker, you've just been listening to. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He's a common figure in news media talking about economic matters, not as common as I would like, an author of many books, including the new book we're talking about today, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy. If you'd like to call into Media Matters, our telephone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about the state of the economy today, where it's going, the politics behind the big decisions about the future of the economy. So anything goes today. We'll be talking about healthcare too, so call in with your questions or comments. Dean Baker, I do want to ask you about the Obama team that's come into office the last year, year and a half. And in your view, I mean, how does it compare to the McCain team that would have come in or to the Bush team that was there? What sort of differences are there between the Obama administration's approach to dealing with the economy from what the Republicans would have done?
Well, there's certainly some differences. The Bush team and presumably the McCain team was oriented towards the same direction. They would have pushed tax cuts as kind of front and center, and I don't know if they would have looked to cut taxes further. Well, actually, given we're in the middle of a downturn, they probably would have pushed for more tax cuts. And the policy certainly that President Bush had was he had tax cuts oriented on giving more money to the richest people in the country. And McCain was pretty clear he would have continued that pattern. Now, they didn't anticipate the downturn during the campaign. It really, well, they anticipated the downturn, but not the severity of the downturn, I should say. What I guess would have happened is they probably would have proposed an even bigger set of tax cuts, again, focused on higher income people, focused on the income tax. And, you know, I don't doubt they would have done some of the things that President Obama has done. I mean, it's hard to believe they wouldn't have extended unemployment benefits, for example. I just can't imagine that they wouldn't have done that, because it's pretty hard to believe you'd sit here with 10% of the workforce unemployed and, you know, not getting benefits in many cases. I mean, already many of them don't get benefits, but I don't think they would have tried to cut off for even more. They wouldn't have been one of the things President Obama deserves a lot of credit for. I don't think it's that widely appreciated. For the first time, people on unemployment insurance also get 65% of their health insurance covered through COBRA. So we've had COBRA, I'm forgetting now what the acronym stands for, but essentially it means after you've lost your job, you have the option to continue to get health insurance. If you had health insurance provided through your employer, you can continue to stay on that plan for up to 2.5 years, paying the premium. Now, for people who lost their jobs because they got laid off, that was sort of a worthless benefit because very few people could afford the premiums. But one of the things that President Obama put into effect with the stimulus package was that it now covers 65% of the health insurance premium for workers that are getting unemployment benefits. So I doubt McCain would have done that had he become president. So that's an important step. The one other thing is that the Obama administration doesn't have the same hostility. Well, I may take this back in a minute, but they don't have the same hostility to Social Security, Medicare as McCain. I mean, I think they both, in both programs, McCain and if we take a look at Bush before him, they were interested quite explicitly in unraveling them. Now, I will qualify that in a second, that President Obama has made a point of saying he wants to get the deficit down, and he appointed this deficit commission, and the people he put there at the head of it, Alan Simpson as the Republican head, the former Republican senator from Wyoming, and Erskine Bowles, who was a top official in the Clinton administration, are both very clear in their willingness to cut substantially Social Security and Medicare. So Obama has not expressed the same hostility to those programs that either President Bush or Senator McCain has, but certainly that was not a good sign that he's willing to put these two people in charge of that commission.
You know, Dean Baker, let me just, before we go to the phone lines, let me follow up on this thing about the deficit. I think in the news media, we hear constantly about how bad the government deficit is and how politicians talk about how it will destroy the economy. And it seems that it's hard to understand exactly what the how bad deficits are or what role they play. Why do we have them? Could you just talk a little bit about how we should think about deficits and understand these debates when they come up in the news media?
Yeah, well, a deficit is supposed to be harmful. I mean, if we just go to Econ 101, you know, why are we worried that we have a deficit? Well, a deficit's supposed to be harmful because it crowds out private investment. The classic story is we get a big deficit, interest rates go up, and then because interest rates are high, firms stop investing, and then we make the economy poorer because we're not investing. We're not building new plant equipment. We're not investing in research, and that means, you know, 5 years, 10 years out, the economy won't be as wealthy as it otherwise would have been. That's sort of the classic Econ 101 line about why a deficit's bad. It's very hard to tell that story right now because the economy is basically falling off a cliff, and the deficit's the only thing supporting the economy. I mean, people have this idea, well, we have this government waste, and then, again, they want to tell the story that might be true if we were in more normal times, or could have some truth to it, that if somehow the government weren't spending the money, the private sector would be spending it. But you really can't tell that story with a straight face today. Interest rates are at extremely low levels. They're the lowest levels basically in 50 years. It's very hard to tell a story that there's any business anywhere that would somehow be spending more money on investment or anything for that matter were it not for the government deficits. Right now, the government deficits are supporting the economy, and the story here is very simple. People work for money. That's not a terribly radical proposition. People work for money. If the private sector spends it, great, but it's not doing it right now. If we didn't have the government spending the money, and that means running a deficit, then we'd have even fewer people employed. We'd have an even higher rate of unemployment. It's a fairly straightforward proposition. You're trying to create demand in the economy, and that's what the deficit does.
Our guest, Dean Baker, author of the new book, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. His co-director, Mark Weisbrot, also a frequent guest here on Media Matters. Together, they are two of the outstanding economists and economic journalists of our times. The number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to our first caller. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Good morning. Oddly enough, I agree with most everything you're saying, but to return to the stock market fiasco,
mm-hmm.
What I'm really trying to understand, I've read a few of the books on it, just about Lehman Brothers and such, to what were these people really fooled, or did they really think this was going on forever, or did they just were making money like hand over fist, and they just went for the ride, and they didn't really care? They knew and didn't care. What's Bernanke's mindset with this? Can you tell me all?
That's a really good question. My guess is that there's a combination of both, that people were making money hand over fist. And in that context, the easiest thing is to just step away and just say, okay, well, let it keep going. And this is why, you know, people think I have something personal against Bernanke. I've really never met him. I mean, I've been in a room with him, seminars or whatever, but I don't personally know him at all. But people think I'm vindictive against Bernanke because I say it's really important that he get fired, not as sort of a moral issue, although there certainly is arguably one. I mean, here you have 10 million people out of work, not because they're lazy or lack the skills, but Bernanke messed up and they're out of work and he's not. That is a little ironic. But more importantly, the incentive structure, because if Bernanke had done what I had wanted him to do, so he goes, hey, there's a bubble here. This is really bad news. We're going to do everything we can, everything we have to rein it in. Then, well, you have Goldman making lots of money on this. Citi's making lots of money. Merrill Lynch, all the big Wall Street firms are making a ton of money on it, not to mention a lot of people around the country. Real estate brokers are making a lot of money on it. So here Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan are being real sourpusses trying to, you know, spoil everyone's fun. So these people go running to their friends at the Treasury, at the White House, in Congress, and they say, you got these nutballs at the Federal Reserve Board. They're trying to ruin everything. We're making money. Everything's just fine. It's not going to be easy for a Federal Reserve Board chair or any government regulator to do that. It's going to be really hard. You're going to have all these people saying that they're nuts. You know, here, this is all just fine, and these guys are just crazy. They don't understand. You know, that's surely what they've done, no doubt about it. So that's the hard thing for Bernanke to do or Greenspan to do. The easier thing is just conserve, you know, look away and go, well, you know, just look away and say things are fine and they'll take care of themselves. And then even when it blows up in your face, and this is why I'm saying it's so important that Bernanke get fired, even when it blows up and you have the worst possible disaster, really, I mean, it's a horrible situation. Again, you'd say it could be worse, but realistically, no one was projecting anything this bad. And if you could still keep your job, well, what's the message to the next Fed chair who sees something getting out of hand? Well, they could make a big issue and risk their job, risk their standing. You know, maybe they'll be driven from, it's happened before. You had a Fed chair under Carter who was chased out, driven, away in shame. Or alternatively, you just go with the flow, and if and when things blow up, you just go, well, who could have known? And so I think, you know, he just did the easiest thing. The easiest thing was just go along. And did he have some idea that this could end badly? I'm sure he did. He's certainly not a stupid man. He understands the economy. So I'm sure he had some idea it could end badly. He probably didn't think it would end as badly as it did, but I think he just went the easy route.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Our guest is Dean Baker, author of the book False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580. The phone lines here are open at 333-9455, and the toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back now to line two, Champaign County. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Regards this afternoon. Regards to your colleague Mark and the crew at the Institute, because it seems like with all the big money arrayed to produce the opinions that are necessary to scare people about Social Security, I wanted to ask you if you thought it was productive to talk about the Peterson Foundation incident that was chronicled by the Media Watchdog Group there, because you were involved in uncovering that. And it seems to me that you mentioned the Social Security Farm Commission. I heard a quote from another economic analysis from the left Business Observer, that there's a quote from Obama floating around that he's agnostic about the need for Social Security reform, which doesn't sound very positive to me either, and after the evidence of Simpson and this other fellow. That's a lot to chew on right there. But I wanted to point out I do hear you more regularly on call-in shows, and I did hear you going opposite somebody who, just a right-wing people who seem to be totally clueless about what to do. They suggest that we should do what Reagan did. I guess that means, billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars of military Keynesianism and reflate the economy with some more, unproductive military spending debt or something like that. Relatively unproductive, I should say. It's just frustrating to hear people just making that kind of a simple nostrum about what their solution is. And I appreciate all your work at CEPR.net. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Dean Baker, any comments?
Yeah, well, a couple things just to sort of quickly back up. First off, I really appreciate the compliments for myself and certainly my colleagues at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We do a lot, and it's good to hear people appreciate it. In terms of the Peterson incident, just to fill people in here, Pete Peterson's an investment banker, a billionaire, and he's recently given $1 billion to fund a foundation. And I have to say I'm still not fully clear on the relationship with the foundation or whether it's Peterson personally, but he's also started a news service called the Fiscal Times. And what he's trying to do is have the Fiscal Times treated like the Associated Press is a neutral news source. And he got the Washington Post to run a story that was written by the Fiscal Times really without any clear identification of its source. And it's a very pernicious trend, because basically Peterson's a person with a very clear agenda. He's been pushing to cut Social Security and Medicare for decades. He started the Concord Coalition back in, I think it was 91 or 92, which has been trumpeting how Social Security and Medicare are going to bankrupt their children and grandchildren. Peterson personally has written several books making this argument, which he then publicizes with. He takes up full-page ads in the major newspapers and does all sorts of other things to publicize them, getting them a wide audience, given that he doesn't really have any expertise in these areas. So it's a very pernicious, to my mind, development to see him creating what I consider a fake news service, and then the Washington Post, one of the country's leading newspapers, at least by its standing, in effect, picking it up and treating the piece as though it were written by Associated Press. And again, no clear identification. I mean, they did identify it as being the Fiscal Times, but they gave the readers no background as to who's behind the Fiscal Times, what their agenda is. And we did manage, FAIR helped on this, FAIR did publicize this, as did other groups. We did manage to call attention to that, and I think the Washington Post did pay a big price, but it still remains to be seen what the future status of the Fiscal Times will be. They've managed to pick up a number of fairly prominent reporters who, as we know, the major newspapers have been laying off reporters or buying them out, as the case may be, and the Fiscal Times has managed to pick up some reporters. Some of them, I have to say, are good reporters. But it is very, very concerning, because regardless, I don't doubt many of these reporters will report stories with honest intentions and try and be balanced, but the agenda of the service itself is very clear. It'd be like the National Rifle Association were putting out a service, firearms today. Certainly people should appropriately be wary that they're not going to be getting straight news stories
from a National Rifle Association news service, and same with Pete Peterson's Fiscal Times. So we have managed to raise somewhat of an issue about it, but he's got a lot of money behind it, and it's a real concern.
Let's go to our next caller for our guest, of course, Dean Baker, author of False Prophets, you've just been listening to. Now let's go to line three, Rantoul. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a fairly regular follower of your blog, Mr. Baker, and I enjoy reading that. I've been reading it since before the housing bubble burst, and many of the comments that followed your postings ridiculed you as a Chicken Little, and I was happy to see that your predictions were proven right. Not really happy, but they were accurate predictions, I guess.
Thanks.
And I myself want to echo the shout out to President Obama about the COBRA payment being reduced. That helped me. I'm a co-owner of a construction company, and my wife was had a real job, I guess, and I couldn't afford health insurance, but through her job we had that she got laid off and had been laid off until just for about 14 months until just this month. And the 65% COBRA payment really helped us, particularly considering our pre-existing conditions. She just recently took a job, but she had to go to Des Moines, Iowa to get a job in her field, so... the state of the economy is still rocky as a concerning employment. But I had a question for you. When the stock market tanked following the housing bubble burst, I had reduced, just at the bottom, had reduced my co-payment for, or my payment for my RIRA. And when just before that, actually, when before it collapsed, and when it collapsed, I increased it to the max, and then just recently I cut it back again. Was that a wise move to do? It looked like, at least on paper, it looks like I did pretty good. Should I be, do you think the stock market's still going to be going through some roller coaster moves? And that's about all I had to ask, and I'll go ahead and hang up and listen online.
Thank you very much, caller. Dean Baker, stock market crystal ball.
Well, I'm not a big stock market forecaster, but there are a couple of things that, I just sort of say as a general principle. There are times you could identify when a market's clearly overvalued. So in the late 90s, the market was clearly overvalued, and, I was writing about this. I took my own advice, and in March of 1998, I took my retirement fund out of stock, put all in bonds. If I'd listened to my own advice more carefully, I might have done that a year earlier. I was glad I waited. You're never going to get a peak, or at least I'm not going to. You have to be a much better timer, get a peak, get a trough. But you could sort of look at general measures, and the stock market certainly, it was sort of a safe bet to say most people in the market hadn't anticipated the troubles ahead, so it was reasonable to assume that there was going to be bad news. Then at some point, given how much the market had fallen, I felt it was pretty safe. So once you had a market that was down 30, 40, eventually fell about 50%, I think even a little more against its peaks, it was a pretty safe bet. Now, picking the bottom there, I wasn't able to do it. Maybe someone would have been able to point to March. We went bottom out March of last year. I don't know what happened in March particularly. It caused it to turn around. It fell lower than I ever thought it would have. It's still, I consider it, a fairly low price, so I don't think anyone who's looking to be in the market for long term has all that much to worry about. But that certainly doesn't mean that it might not drop 10-15%, because I think there's a lot of bad news that yet to come that I don't think is necessarily anticipated by investors in the market. So I'm not going to try and tell you, what it's going to do the rest of 2010 or 2011, but just as a long-term proposition, I don't think it's an overvalued market, so if you're looking to be there for the next 10, 15, 20 years, there's probably not a lot to worry about.
Dean Baker, before we go to our next two callers, I do want to ask you to talk quickly about one chapter in the book I found infuriating but also illuminating, which was your discussion of the TARP, Troubled Asset Program, that was put in place in September 2008, when the crisis really became the big story of our times. And your chapter on that and discussion of that in the book is, as I said, infuriating. And I think that a lot of people have a bad taste in their mouth, but it's been sort of thrown down the memory hole. Can you just say a few words about that before we go back to the phone lines?
Yeah, people have to really understand what was going on there. In September, this was after you'd had the collapse of Lehman, AIG's rescued, and the financial markets are in very, very serious stress, and many other major banks are on the edge of collapse. Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, they're all, on their last leg at that point. And they go running to Congress, we need $700 billion right away, no questions asked. And they did everything they could to intimidate members of Congress. You had Bernanke and Paulson, the Treasury Secretary at the time, saying, look, the world's about to end. We need the money tomorrow. And I actually talked to many staffers and many members of Congress, and I was saying, look, they are seriously stressed. They do need money. It'd be good to keep them from collapsing. But the bottom line is you could put conditions on it. You could make it so that Wall Street is never the same. And this was the moment where there was 100% leverage in the sense that they had no options to say no. I mean, my line, just to kind of make a joke out of it, but also to illustrate the point, we could have told these guys they had to run around Wall Street naked with their underpants on their head. They'd have had no choice because their banks were going under otherwise. But it was totally flipped around, and instead somehow all the pressure was on us. We have to give them the money. And that was what Congress ended up doing. And it was really just an incredible time. I remember I wrote a column, I have a weekly column with The Guardian, which is, the progressive newspaper, and I gave it the headline, they have a gun, the banks have a gun pointed to their heads, and they're threatening to pull the trigger. They never used my headlines, but in this case they used it simply changing it around. They flipped the gun around, banks have a gun pointed to our heads. And that was not true. That was not true. The gun was pointed to their heads. The bad thing that happened would have been Goldman went out of business, Morgan Stanley went out of business, Citigroup would go out of business, Bank of America would go out of business. We could pick up the pieces. That was not a desirable outcome. The best outcome was to keep them in business but totally change the way they operate forever. Instead, we just gave them the money, business as usual.
And what's striking about it, as I read it in the book, and I recall the period like it was yesterday, was that there's tremendous popular opposition to this across the political spectrum. Just people thought this was outrageous on one hand. But on the other hand, the news media, in a way that would make Izvestia or Pravda ashamed by comparison, uniformly almost marked in this complete lockstep that anyone who opposed the TARP bailout was, just a knucklehead who knew nothing about economics.
Absolutely. It just became, it was like the intelligentsia, the intelligent people against everyone else. And I remember I was on an NPR show, in fact, the day after it was voted down, because, of course, the House of Representatives voted it down the first time. They voted up again 4 days later. But initially, to everyone's surprise, it was voted down. And there was this real panic. And I was on this show where it was actually talking about something else. But in any case, the host of the show at the breaks was saying, God, can you believe Congress did that? And I said, yeah, I thought it was a good thing. And the other person was on the show, this woman who also, had, I think she's a lawyer, but in any case, the point was she was a well-educated person. So you're sitting there with two people who are obviously well-educated. We could be stupid, but in any case, we had credentials. And, we're both saying, yeah, we thought it was a good thing. And he looked at us. He was just appalled. And, of course, he knew nothing of the economics, but he just was repeating what everyone else was telling him. So, wanting to be an educated person himself, he naturally said the same thing. There was just, you just had, a complete shutout of views of those who opposed the TARP. And that was true on the Hill as well. I could tell you this. It was a remarkable story that the Democrats, the Democratic leadership, did not want any economist who opposed or even questioned the TARP to speak to the Democratic caucus. And, I went down there. I was there with Jamie Galbraith, another economist, and Bill Harris, who'd been the head of the FDIC back in the 80s during the crisis associated with bad Latin American debt. And we spoke to the Skeptics Caucus. It was roughly 45 Democrats. I didn't do a count, but my guess is somewhere around 45. And they wanted us to speak to the larger caucus, and the leadership absolutely refused. And finally, they agreed that if people want to stay around, they've been meeting all afternoon and evening, if they want to stay around, I think it was finally 8:30, we had a chance to talk with some of the other members. But they didn't even want them to hear from economists that opposed, or in Jamie's case, Jamie Galbraith, he actually told them he thought they should vote for it, but he was raising questions about it.
We have a full bank of phone callers for Dean Baker, our guest today, the author of False Prophets here on Media Matters, and I'm going to go to all of them. I guarantee I'll get to you before the show's over. Let's start right now with line four, Champaign. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Dean, thanks for all your work. One quick question I wanted to pick up on related to the TARP. It seems that the press accounts have it that the banks seem to have paid back most of the money that was lent to them. Is that true? And if so, should that affect the way that we think about the TARP? But I also had a couple of questions relating to your comments about the deficit earlier. It seems like any time we talk about social spending, the fear of a bloated deficit comes up, but not so in relation to the military. I'm wondering if you could shed any light on why that is. And also perhaps talk about the long-term deficit and if we should be worried about increasing debt, especially in relation to the use of the dollar throughout the world and the amount that we're owed by or that we owe to foreign central banks, and if that's really the worry that it's made out to be in the press sometimes. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Dean Baker?
Okay, well, first off, the repayment of the TARP, people have to understand what exactly happened here. This is, we're out there in the desert, and people are dying of thirst, or in this case, the banks were dying of thirst. We gave them water. Now they're saying, you know, it's been raining, and we're sitting by, you know, Lake Michigan. And they're going, oh, we gave you the water back. What's the issue? The point was that they were absolutely desperate. And, of course, they profited from the water we gave them. They sold it to other people who were dying of thirst. They made it, they were allowed to stay alive, restore themselves to profitability because of public handouts. So now they're saying we paid the money back. Well, that's nice, but you know the fact was at the point where we gave that to them, that meant a huge, huge amount. The fact that they paid it back, that's really kind of beside the point. It's good, but you know that's really beside the point. We gave them money that was a much, much greater value. And the best proof of this, almost the same time, I think it was about 3 days, maybe a week before they got money through the TARP, Warren Buffett gave roughly the same amount of money to Goldman Sachs and charged them more than twice as much. That was the market interest rate. That's what Warren Buffett got. So, you know, we did not get market rate, and getting something below market rate is a handout. And so they got enormous, you know, Goldman Sachs, you know, their billionaires got enormous amount of money from us. The other questions, yeah, I mean, it's remarkable how defense spending is just left out of the picture, and I looked at that recently because it's kind of striking. You know, we don't talk about that much. I just looked at what the projections were for military spending in 2010 back in 2001 before September 11th. They're spending about twice as much. We're spending about $300 billion more a year on the military than what was projected back in September, just before September 11th. And obviously, it makes a big difference. That is a big story, and you could argue it's necessary spending. I mean, you could argue that. We could decide that. But the point is, you can't argue that it's been a big factor adding to the deficit, because certainly it has been. Now, the last point, the longer-term story, I keep saying it's healthcare. This is a healthcare story. We look out 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and you can project really high deficits. But that's because our healthcare costs are way out of line with the rest of the world, and they're projected to get even more out of line in coming decades. Now, if that's true, that'll have a devastating impact on the economy, but it will also mean, since we pay for more than half of our health care now through the public sector, through Medicare, Medicaid, and other programs, there'll be a real big budget problem. But that just emphasizes the importance of fixing health care. Now, your last point, there's been kind of a xenophobia here that, oh, my God, we should fear that China, other countries, China's usually the one mentioned here, they're buying up all the debt. China buys, they have a conscious policy of keeping up the dollar, keeping down their currency, which they do by buying up huge amounts of U.S. assets. That's buying up U.S. assets. It happens to be that most of that's government debt. But if they had the same policy with their currency, and suppose we had a balanced budget, they'd be buying shares of private corporations. They'd be buying debt of private corporations, or maybe they'd buy mortgage-backed securities. If we're concerned about indebtedness to China, then the discussion has to be the trade deficit, has to be the value of the dollar against the yuan. The government deficit has no place in that. So the people who talk about government deficit China, they're simply trying to promote racist, xenophobic sentiments. You know, that's not a serious discussion.
Our guest, Dean Baker, author of the new book, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, just out with Polypoint Press. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., a frequent guest in the program. Let's go back to the phone lines now to our next caller, Line 1, Urbana. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that it seems like there's kind of a general attitude that everybody accepts that capitalism is the only model for our economy that would work. And like you mentioned earlier, if you question anything, you just don't understand economics. And to me, it doesn't seem like it's really working. So I just wondered if you in general believe that maybe there's a better model for looking at how to run our economy. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Dean Baker?
Well, I'm certainly open to exploring alternatives, but the idea that somehow we're going to shift from where we are today to some fundamentally different system, I just don't see that as a plausible story. So if we're going to move in a different direction, it has to be by steps. And, you know, if we look at getting to capitalism from feudalism, well, the way we did that was capitalism got built up in a feudal, in the context of feudalism. So I'm all for experiments with alternative forms of ownership, cooperatives, worker cooperatives. I mean, there's other things we could talk about. But I don't envision going from, you know, where we are today, something totally different. So if someone's got an agenda that goes step by step, you know, put it on the table and let's look at it.
Well, let me ask you a question sort of related to that, Dean Baker. And I've asked most of the economists, we've had some great economists on the show, and I recorded an interview with Stiglitz. It'll be airing in a couple of weeks. And oftentimes I'll ask them, you know, when you, your work points out how important the bubbles have been to propping up economic growth for the last two decades in the U.S. economy. And the role of debt and the massive increase of the financial sector has been so important in stimulating growth in the last few decades. Is there an argument or a concern that maybe the type of capitalism we've got in the United States today is just not capable of high growth any longer, that it's for whatever reasons, it seems to be have some fundamental flaws that require these bubbles in order to even like get close to full employment?
Yeah, well, I think there are certainly very fundamental flaws in the direction we've taken in the last three decades. I mean, I guess, you know, at the end of the day, I guess I'd say capitalism is a very, very flexible system. So we could talk about many different types of capitalism. That's what I'm thinking. We're more likely to go to sort of a different type of capitalism rather than something that's fundamentally different, a different system altogether. But certainly, the last three decades, we've seen an explosion of the financial sector as a share of the economy. And most recently, its share of corporate profits has been more than a third, which is just sort of an incredible thing to think of. The amount of resources used up in running just very narrowly the investment banking commodities trading sector, that's quintupled relative to the size of the economy from where it was back in the 70s. And you're very hard-pressed to say what we're getting for that. So I think we have an enormously bloated financial sector. It's really distorted the economy. It's not working for the vast majority of people, and it does have to be reined in. I mean, my pet proposal when people are talking about all this financial reform, the thing that I throw out that you know, I ignore everything else that's being discussed and take this as a financial transactions tax. Rein in the financial sector. I think that would have 20 times the impact of everything that's on everyone else's wish list.
And you discuss it, I might add, at the end of False Profits in the final chapter with your recommendations. Let's go back to our phone lines again to another patient caller, this time one from New York, New York. Line two, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to talk about an area that's generally not covered in the mainstream media and would probably be called class warfare in those contexts. But specifically on the flip side of the deficits and the spending is the amount of tax revenue that we actually take in this country. And a lot of times you hear people talk about, you know, under Eisenhower we had a top marginal tax rate of 91%, and, you know, and since it's been dropped, you know, into the 30s, 20s, et cetera. But why doesn't anyone ever really talk about what that top marginal tax bracket is and how it's essentially gotten so low that we have, you know, what could be described as a flat tax or even a regressive tax code now, especially considering Medicare and Social Security, the two most popular entitlement programs in the country, are essentially regressive taxes. What is the history of when that became a regressive tax, and then also when the top marginal tax rate now, which, you know, it's 250, 375, something like that, you know, became such a relatively low number? What's wrong with taxing people over 5 million or even 50 million? Or, you know, if we only took it to the absurd, what if we only taxed the, you know, Forbes 400 level and took a major haircut off of their, you know, second or third $100 million? Could that, you know, really account for these huge deficits that we've rolled up over the last three decades?
Thank you very much, caller. And Dean Baker, perhaps before you answer that, just maybe for listeners who aren't familiar with this terminology, explain what we mean when we use the term progressive or regressive taxation.
Well, there's 2 points I'll make there. First off, progressive simply means that people who have higher incomes pay a larger share of their income in taxes. Regressive means people who have lower incomes pay a larger share of their income in taxes. The other point that's really central and people often get confused about is the idea of a marginal tax rate. I don't know how much the right certainly likes to play on this. They go, oh, people are going to pay a 90% tax rate, and they think that people are going to pay 90% of their income in taxes. Marginal tax rate means tax over a certain level. So if we had, let's say, a 90% marginal tax rate for income over $1 million, that doesn't mean if someone made $1,100,000 that they would pay 90% of that $1,100,000 in taxes. They would pay 90% of the $100 in taxes and then a considerably lower tax rate on their first million. Now, in terms of can we charge higher tax rates, the reality in the Eisenhower years, that was when we had the 90% rate, is very few people, if any, paid that actual 90% rate. There were a lot of loopholes. First and foremost, capital gains were taxed at half that rate. So if most of your income came from capital gains, which for the highest income people was almost certainly true, they're paying at most a 45% rate, and there were a lot of loopholes that often meant they paid less than that. The current top tax rate is 39%, and then, well, I shouldn't say is, it will be after December 31st next year. The Bush tax cuts expire at the end of this year. So it will be 39.6% actually. And then they also will pay the Medicare tax on wage income, which is 2.95%. So it's about 41-42%. You could raise that a little. I'm a little hesitant to raise that too much, not because I'm worried about wealthy people not being able to pay it, but as you raise the tax, there is something to be said for this. You give them a lot of incentive to evade it. And if you give people enough incentive to evade it, they find ways to do that. And, you know, we could spend more money enforcing it, but there's a point at which that does become counterproductive. I should also say that, you know, let's say we had a top marginal rate of 45 or 50%. Any additional revenue you could get by raising that to 70, 80, 90, 95 would be relatively small in the scheme of things. You aren't going to get a huge amount that way. So it's not as though we could eliminate our deficits by raising the top rate. You could get a bit more than we have. There are other things you could do with the tax code. Right now, the top tax rate on capital gains is just 15%. I think that's absurd. So there's certainly things you could do to get more tax from high-income people, but you aren't going to be able to make up the deficits that way.
Our guest, Dean Baker. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines now to our next caller, this one from Portland, Oregon, on line 3. Hello, you're talking with Dean Baker.
Hi, Dean. I admire your work. You've already touched on my question, but I'd like you to expand on what you said. We recently seen an escalation in the rhetorical debate between the Obama administration and China over currency. And I'm curious, first, whether you agree that China needs to let the yuan appreciate, and if you do, whether the United States has much leverage economically or politically to reduce our trade deficit with China. Thanks a lot.
Well, I think we should see the dollar fall against the yuan. I've always been skeptical about exactly what goes on here, because I think it was a big mistake. I mean, we had the dollar go up against the yuan years ago. I mean, it's been overvalued really since the late 90s, and the trade deficit with China has expanded enormously. And this was actually conscious policy of the Clinton administration. They wanted a high dollar, you know, so that's part of the story. High dollar means a low yuan and means large trade deficits. But they touted that. They said, this is great. And there is a story there that it keeps down inflation. You get all these goods from China at very low cost. Now, if the yuan were to rise against the dollar, then suddenly all these goods that we get very cheaply from China suddenly start costing us more money. That would be upward pressure on inflation. So if you're concerned first and foremost with the low inflation rate, then that's bad news. So I haven't been convinced that that was necessarily U.S. policy. It's public policy that we wanted them to raise the value of the yuan, but I'm not sure what went on in negotiations. And important thing to keep in mind, you know, I don't doubt that when Secretary Geithner goes in negotiations with his counterparts from China, that he's got on the list he wants them to raise the value of the yuan. But they have a whole set of items on their list. They want greater protection for copyrights in China and patents, and you know, they're raising issues about greater access to financial markets for Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. So Secretary Geithner is going in there with, you know, this list of, you know, 5, 10, 15 items, and one of them is a higher value of the yuan. I'm not convinced, and I'm inclined to think it's not the case, that he's actually saying, you know, this is what we really want. You know, these other things are good or whatever, but this is front and center. Now, at the end of the day, it's important to understand the U.S. isn't powerless. I always get a kick out of this, that we get the kind of incredible hoax story about the United States that when there's something that, say, progressives want the government to do in international relations, you know, well, we're really weak. We can't get the other countries to do what we want. But when there's something, you know, when George W. Bush wants to fight the war on terrorism, he tells everyone, you're going to come along, you're going to cooperate, you know, or you're on the other side, and then that's really bad news for you. Well, if we really wanted it, there are things we could do. In this case, it's actually very simple. China sets an exchange rate against the dollar. We could set an exchange rate against the yuan. So in their case, they price the yuan at about 15 cents. We could say, we think that's too low. You come to Treasury, we'll give you 20 cents. We could make that the official exchange rate for the yuan. An extreme move, but we have the power to do that. And if we were actually serious about raising the value of the yuan, presumably what we'd do is we'd tell our counterparts in China that, you know, as of February 1st, 2011, we're going to start paying people 20 cents for every yuan at the Treasury. And my guess is that you would fairly quickly work out a deal with China where they would have a process where they gradually raise the value of the yuan over a period of time.
Dean Baker, we've only got a few minutes left on the program today, and we've only touched on just a smattering of what's in your new book, False Prophets. I do think, though, I want to conclude by giving you an opportunity to talk about, you describe in the book and in your writings the real trouble our economy faces right now, the severe unemployment that's not going to go away, that is the worst probably it's been since the 1930s in any real terms. And let's say President Obama were tuning into the show today and heard you speak and thought you were making some very good points. Were he to call you up and say, Dean Baker, what's your agenda? What should I do for this economy? What bill should I take to Congress? What would be the sort of things you think make a lot of sense as a stimulus bill to get this economy moving in the next 2, 3, 4 years?
Well, I mean, there's both short-term measures and long-term measures. Short-term, I place the first priority in getting people back to work, and I actually think the quickest way to do this is following a program in place in Germany and the Netherlands, and it's called work sharing. You simply get people to work shorter hours, which I think is something that would be good in and of itself. But basic idea is that you give tax credits to employers for keeping people on instead of laying them off and paying them pretty much the same pay. That's been the model they've used in those countries, and their unemployment rates basically stayed constant even though they've had steeper downturns than we have. Longer term, you can look to do modernize our infrastructure, do things like build fast trains. I mean, it's just kind of incredible that we have, you know, to some extent a working train system in the northeast, but just about nowhere else. That would certainly be a very good environmental project. But there's a number of other areas where, with a little money spent on research and development, we could really go a long way, certainly in the environmental sector, but also I think of revamping our prescription drug system. If we had publicly funded research and could make drugs available at competitive market prices instead of patent-protected prices, we could save ourselves hundreds of billions of dollars a year. There's a lot of ways in which we could look to relatively quickly both boost demand and also create lasting benefits. So I think if he gives me a call, I can give him a pretty full agenda.
But you do make the point, and I want to make this clear, that the sort of stimulus that's been done so far is insufficient to the job at hand. More significantly greater spending by the federal government is necessary, and that means deficit spending.
Yeah, we're off in order of magnitude. We've seen a fall off in private sector demand under the order of $1.2-1.3 trillion. And if you look at the net stimulus from the government sector, this is federal spending minus cutbacks at the state and local sector, it's been around about $130, $140 billion a year. So we need like 10 times as much. We're really far off from spending as much as we need to get the economy back near full employment.
Do you think there's any likelihood that Congress will revisit this situation and maybe enact a much larger stimulus bill?
I'm not terribly confident. I mean, if that's going to happen, President Obama has to be prepared to take the lead. And he's just been, it's really been painful. He's been extremely cautious. And, you know, you understand politicians urge to be cautious because they're concerned first and foremost about getting reelected. But he really was facing an extraordinary situation. There was a lot of excitement, a lot of enthusiasm around his election. I mean, it was the biggest margin of victory of any Democrat since Lyndon Johnson in 64, obviously being the first African-American president's a big deal. And he came in the middle of an economic crisis. He really had opportunities open to him
that weren't there for any president in really since Roosevelt, and he's just let them slip away.
On that note, Dean Baker, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Media Matters.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Our guest, Dean Baker. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for engineering the show. Melissa Trentz, as always, for being the producer. We'll be back in 167 hours. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, light rain today with a high of 53 degrees. Tonight, rain is likely with a low of 38. The chance of precipitation, 70%. Monday, mostly cloudy with a high of 55. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low of 32. And Tuesday, sunny with a high of 58. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM.